price of improvement is failure. Welcome to Liquid Philosophy.
But we do need to get Justin a better...
I'm not opposed to it. I've had many nicknames in my life.
Character.
I know. Well, we're not going to go that route.
I had Jack Daniels in college because I would always drink a lot of Jack Daniels and they never knew what they're going to get. If it was going to be an asshole or if it was going to be fun to hang out with. You can start recording whenever
not
you're ready.
Not much has changed, is it?
Awesome.
You're like, I am.
Yeah,
I suspect this is going to be my undoing.
Hopefully.
After 40 years in this city, this will be my
Bob
undoing.
Weinberg, I think
he'll
be okay.
At the end.
If you're looking to get out of the city, we're going to send you right out after this.
Wow.
Listen, I did my first podcast interview the other day, and I didn't even know that I could watch this fellow who was interviewing me on my computer screen. So I did the whole thing by phone in the blind. I mean, that's how little I know about digital media. I am a dinosaur when it comes to this stuff.
On
most topics. But you're an expert on this if you just did another podcast interview.
Yeah, I guess.
Once
yeah,
you've done I, three, that makes what, you an expert.
Really? Okay.
All right.
There was a big old grin.
Okay. Should we go?
Well, hello there, Liquid Philosophy fans. We are back with a vengeance because today we're having our first, what I'm going to call, off-campus edition. So we are talking with Dr. Michael Roberto, who is a retired faculty member from North Carolina A&T State University from the History Department, retired since December of 2016. So congratulations, because I think many of us, like on the other side of the table, are hoping that that day might happen at some point.
I got 29
more
years.
29
more
years to go. I have no idea where I'm at these days. So, but anyway, welcome to Liquid Philosophy.
Well,
and we
you.
Are excited to hear a little bit about your career and your advocacy and activism and all of the great and wonderful, I guess, hell that you like to raise
it
as
does.
Part of your work in life. So we'll see. We'll dig into that a little bit.
Okay.
So with you, as always, I am Marianne LaGreco from the Department of Communication Studies at UNCG.
I am Jeremy Rinker from Peace and Conflict Studies at UNCG.
Who we lovingly call Dr. Squirrelbeard.
Yes, Dr. Squirrelbeard.
Yes.
Went from drinker to Dr.
Squirrelbeard.
It's getting better. And I'm Justin Harmon from Community and Therapeutic Recreation.
And I'm pretty sure we need to start some sort of like fan petition to give Justin a nickname. Because
yeah.
I got MLG. And Jeremy is now Dr. Squirrelbeard.
Not by choice.
But we were just talking about this.
But he lovingly embraces it, though.
He does.
My kids have actually taken it up.
That's awesome.
To be honest. Thanks, Justin.
You're welcome.
It's going to be on like a Christmas card next year. It's going to be Dr. Squirrelbeard and the boys. All right. So.
Well, you're also the Scoutmaster, though, too.
That's right. That was the third one
you
used.
Maybe Justin's just good with coming up with bad
And this is
things,
coming from the Eagle Scout. That's
right.
The thing that's
Ooh.
Funny. So
Doctor,
that my
Scout's
Ooh,
honor.
There we go.
You were an Eagle Scout?
Oh, yeah.
Dr.
Really?
Squirrelbeard and the Eagle Scout.
I never knew that.
Yeah?
I'm not surprised.
I don't know if that's a good not surprise.
That's quite amazing.
Thank
wow.
you. I
can't
tell if you're. I can't tell if you're being sarcastic right
now. No, I just thought of a nickname for you.
Oh, good.
Yes.
What is it?
I'll share it with you at the end of the show.
Keep drinking, then.
All right.
It'll be even funnier at the reveal at the end. All right. Well, welcome, Michael Roberto. We are very excited to have you with us. We would like to toast to you
yes.
in joining us on Liquid
you.
Philosophy.
Oh,
so I will
looks
hand
like that,
things off to Dr. Squirrelbeard himself.
Right. And it looks like that's what it says on our schedule here. Dr. Squirrelbeard gives the toast.
Yes. Yes. So without further ado.
So here's to health, happiness, and the good work that we all do and continuing on for a long time to Marxists and everyone else.
Well, thank you very much.
Cheers.
This is, to be honest with you, this is the first such toast that I have gotten from anyone since I retired.
Hey,
oh, and
so
to
thank
retirement.
You very much. This is very special.
So double so cheers.
You.
Double cheers. Why not?
Well, thank isn't you. It like wedding gifts? So, you don't have to yes. toast for like 3 years afterwards or something like that. You don't have to buy the gift for like 3 years afterwards. All right, well, we're going to jump into our first section, which we call lovingly call Breaking the Seal, which are some rapid-fire questions, so quick responses. Where did you do your graduate work?
Two places, URI and Boston College.
Okay. What was the focus of your dissertation?
Marx's concept of progress.
Mm. Hmm. What's your favorite cuss word?
Oh, fuck.
What was your nickname in high school?
Hey, we're back on nicknames.
I know it. You know it.
And don't forget that one that you're going to give Justin later on.
You know, I don't, to be honest with you, I don't think I was popular enough to have a nickname.
I thought you were called Crazy Mike.
No.
You told me that.
Well, I guess some people did, but it wasn't, it's nothing that really stuck. No, I, to be honest with you, unless I've completely blocked it out,
it's nothing that you
like
would
I've
had.
Done other things in my life, I can't rec- I can't answer that question.
Had emblazoned on the back of your
Well, we'll come up with one for you by the end of this.
All right, you two should trade nicknames.
Yeah, it'll be like a duel.
Yes.
No, I'm not going to do that.
If you could live anywhere in the world, where would it be?
Ooh, good question.
Hmm. Right now,
that's new.
I would have to say Mexico.
Mm. What city?
Well, that's a good question. I've never been to Mexico City, and I've never been to any major city.
What's the one
Mexico.
You went to last year?
It's not a city. It's a small town. It's like a village on Lake Chapala. It's called Ayahic, and it's near Guadalajara. And I suppose that this time, when I go in April, since my son spent a semester in Guadalajara when he was an undergraduate through North Carolina Exchange, I'm sure that he will like showing me around Guadalajara.
Well, we are going to dig a little bit deeper on some of the core questions that we've got for you.
Well, that's
you.
The end of the rapid-fire questions.
That's the end of the rapid-fire. Yeah,
they were rapid.
Fast.
Yeah,
fast.
Really. That was quick.
Right? Yeah. So how did you end up in Greensboro? And from what Justin tells me, it was back in the 80s.
It was... It was a very difficult time in my life, and I was with a woman who became my second wife and the mother of my two children, and she grew up in Greensboro, so that's how I wound up here.
Mm. Gotcha.
Yeah, and that was in 1980, and I've been here ever since.
Where'd you come from?
Well, I grew up in New York. Went to college at a branch of Adelphi University, then lived in New England, lived in Rhode Island for a couple of years while I did my master's there, then in Boston. And then I spent some time in Florida after I left Boston in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s. I can't remember exactly what year I left. It's a blur. And I wound up playing music in Florida for a while, and that's where I met this woman who became my wife in Greensboro, and we had kids, and then the marriage ended.
So how was the northerner going south?
I was thinking the same thing.
The northerner, that's a lot of north.
That's a lot of north, New England in particular.
Well, you know, it's I've always tried to say to people when it matters publicly that I came of age in Greensboro.
Hmm.
And I mean, even as somebody who was fairly well educated up to the point of doing his dissertation, I knew very little about American society until I came to the South.
Hmm.
So my experience in the South was as profoundly important as anything I've ever studied. And since I've been here, the study and the practice went hand in hand.
What was particularly revelatory about it? Like, what were your aha moments?
Black life in the South.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The black nation within the nation,
mm-hmm.
which I understand on some levels and deeply respect.
Hmm. Yeah, it was right after the Greensboro Massacre.
Right.
Like,
right.
So that must have been a pretty... In 1980?
Yes, and I was fortunate to come here, and because I was... already moving in the direction of Marxism, of mm-hmm. becoming a socialist, becoming a communist, whatever you want to call me, whatever anyone wants to call me right now, I know what I am. I mean, it was pivotal when I got here. That was a pivotal moment because what happened here, and the victims, the widows of the victims, the survivors, and what I learned from them was extraordinarily powerful. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, I suppose established in me a tradition, an understanding of where we are in America now, and who we must be, and what we must always try to become, individually and collectively. And so, yes, it was that was a very powerful moment. But it brings its great moments of joy, and it also brings great moments of heartbreak, because that's the nature of the beast in America now.
Yeah.
That's the behemoth.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to the power of fascism in America. Mm.
We'll get to that. Yeah. Part of the game is drinking while you talk, though. So
maybe we need to do another cheers.
Yeah,
cheers.
There you go. Cheers.
We do make you talk a lot, so I feel like
we get
to drink more than you do.
Okay.
That's true.
I'll try to keep up. I mean,
play the game, Michael.
Sounds like some of those early experiences in Greensboro, at least in part, laid some foundation for your activism in Greensboro.
Oh, yeah.
And would you talk a little bit more about that activism and what you tried to push forward in the community?
Well, I mean, I came here, and obviously what happened made certain things clear to me. I didn't understand. I knew who the Nazis were. I knew who the Klan was. I know that the state was behind it, and I know generally who these people were, because of all the work that they had done in the mills and cone mills, and mm-hmm. and I mean what they did to rebuild the union, to revitalize it, and then to have it shut down. So I mean, you know, this was stuff that I knew something about, but I didn't know it in such depth, and I didn't know it in human terms. You know, I mean, these were people whose lives were fundamentally altered by a devastating experience.
Right.
And the experience was based on an attack against people who wanted to make revolutionary change in America.
Mm-hmm.
That experience also then got me into another area of activism in the city, and to some extent where I had some experience elsewhere, because I left Greensboro. We left Greensboro briefly, and then we came back. Mm. And in the time that I was gone, I was involved in the Central America Solidarity Movement, and which actually had a very strong base here. Mm. At UNCG, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Yeah, St. Mary's House. Was the center of really quite amazing political activity opposed to Reagan's foreign policy in Central America.
Mm.
And the Episcopal chaplain at the time, Henry Atkins, was a very strong leader, and it attracted people from the Communist Workers' Party, from the Revolutionary Communist Party, from the Socialist Workers' Party. And, of course, all these parties showed up, and everybody was trying to recruit anyone who was not a member. And that led to serious issues within trying to build a kind of a consensus in the city. But still, I mean, it was a very positive experience. So I became really interested in the history of revolutionary struggle in Central America, and I became a friend of the library at UNCG. It was my first time as a friend of the library, and I read what I think was the equivalent of at least two major fields if I were a doctoral student in the history of Central America. I mean, and that I'm always grateful to the presence of that library, because it was central. It became central to my studies, and then from there, I started to examine the writings of Marx, much more closely than I did when.
So you weren't a Marxist before you came to Greensboro, then?
I was somebody who was in the process
of.
You were
a budding Marxist.
I was yeah. Well, all my friends were in graduate school at Boston College. I mean, I had friends who became, who went on to become very, very powerful historians in their fields, and. We studied together, we hung out together, and they had read a lot more of this stuff than I did. But I was certainly influenced by their thinking and their work, especially the work that they had done as early as students of the Soviet Union, who became part of this whole revisionist understanding of the Cold War and the role of Stalin in turning the Soviet Union in a certain direction, and basically on the cutting edge of shooting down the emigre interpretation of what happened in the Soviet Union, especially around the Great Purges of the 1930s.
Yeah, so I want to dig into that musical career and have you tell us a little bit about that, and particularly you've started to hint at the way that these kind of ideological threads and activism connected through music. So if you could talk a little bit about how did you, when you came to Greensboro as this New Englander or Northerner,
well,
how did that all mesh together?
That's a great question, man. You're really making me think here. And it's a good thought, too, because...
I know Justin doesn't make you think much, so...
Okay. All right. I have to drink some beer.
We have to make him drink some beer. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Take a drink.
Right. Por favor.
That's all the Spanish he knows.
I think probably the moment when I was doing everything full speed probably was around 2009, 2010. I came up for tenure in 2009. I got tenure in 2009. We were involved in the city not long after that in the struggle against reopening the landfill, and I had, I guess around that time, or maybe shortly before that, no, it was probably around that time, we were doing a quintet at a place called The Press, which is now Dane's Chicken and Waffle, which was a really cool club there, and we were doing Thursday nights there, and there were good guys in that. Everybody in that band was great. I mean, I was in over my head. Turner Battle playing keyboard, Mondre Moffat playing trumpet, Leroy Robeson playing bass, Mike Pitts playing drums. I mean, we had it going on, and it was really cool. And it was totally. Everything was improvisational. I mean, we had played with each other for so many years in different forms, in different ways, and we started doing the tunes, but we never did the tunes the same way all of the time because every night was different. But there was a sound coming out of the band, and that was kind of cool, I thought.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then it ended. Yeah.
Sounds a bit like activism.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been in over my head when it comes to activism. Yeah, that's how things happen.
Tell us a little bit about your time at the Carolina Peacemaker. What did you do there?
Wow.
What is the Carolina Peacemaker?
It's a black weekly paper that's been in existence for I don't know how many decades now. I was engaged in a string of jobs, washing dishes, laying cable, and then actually it was my second wife at the time saw an ad in the Peacemaker, saw an ad in the newspaper about the Peacemaker wanted a staff writer, and she said, "Stop wasting your time, go and do it." And you know, I did, and I began. That's how my life as a journalist began. And I guess, as I wrote in my book, in the epilogue of my book, I said it seemed to me that since I had been trained as an historian to look at evidence, that journalism was essentially the same thing. You get the story right based on the facts. And so I learned how to be a journalist from this, just from the seat of my pants. I had a great friend at the time, a great teacher though, and a really extraordinary woman, and one of my greatest friends who's no longer with us. And her name was Ruth L. Howard. She was a journalism major at North Carolina Central, from Eastern North Carolina, and she worked for the Black Paper over in Winston-Salem. I think it was called the Chronicle at the time. And then she came over to the Peacemaker about 9 months after I got there. And for the time that we worked together over the next year or so, we did some extraordinary work. She just taught me everything she taught me so much about stuff. Because there was no, we wrote stories, we took our own photos, we laid out the paper at night. I mean, I was writing house editorials. I had a column.
What was it called?
It was called Black and White. I actually won third place for column writing at the National Newspaper Association meeting one year. It was in 1986, and we all went to this meeting. I forget where it was. And, it was like a large crowd in this large auditorium, and they're calling out the winners, and call out Michael Roberto. Third place column writing, Michael Roberto, and I stand up, and of course, I'm practically, I'm one of the few white people in the place. Yeah. And so that was a great honor. That was awesome. A great honor for me.
Yeah. So you had like three different careers in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Musician, newspaper writer, professor.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, I mean, now that the teaching is over, I can spend more time doing the writing and the music. They are very important to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I have goals this year, and the first goal is to push out my book, and the second goal is to play as much as I can.
Yeah.
Well, you just came out with a book of your own, The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States from 1920 to 1940. Tell us about the process and your interest in doing that project and why it's important to people today to learn about this kind of 20s to 40s period.
Hmm. Well, let me begin by saying that even though I wrote this book, it's all of everything about fascism in America is something that requires even greater learning now on my part. Mm. I'm just beginning to recognize, with the help of Al, actually, of recognizing how deeply consequential my study of the origins of American fascism is to our understanding of what fascism is in world history since it first appeared in 1920. And so I'm looking into a vast area of research possibilities that I in no way can cover on my own by myself. Yeah. So around 2011, I just decided to do my own book on the origins of American fascism. And little did I know that I'd have to read so much American history because I was not trained as an American historian.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so talk about that process a little bit. Because writing a book is a process, right?
Yes.
I would like tips. Right. For me, writing this. The way we're supposed to write books as academics is that we do the research, we put everything together, right? And we draft our outlines, and then our outlines become chapters, and then we write the book from that.
Yeah.
That did not happen.
I thought you were going to say it didn't work.
That
for
did
you.
Not happen. The structure of my book evolved in the context of what I was learning about American fascism while I was learning about contemporary American history, and while I understood both from the standpoint of the present. And so the only thing that really enables me to say that I wrote this book with any credibility as an historian is that I believe that historians can only write good history if they understand the past from the standpoint of the present. And many, many historians do not share that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And that has to do with method.
Yeah. Yeah.
That has to do with method. So I don't know. Did I answer your question about my book?
Yeah,
really?
You did.
Yeah.
Process. I mean, you took it in the more meta process perspective, like the micro process.
No, the micro process was crazy. It was absolutely nuts. I mean, this was a very difficult time in my life. Yeah. The most difficult, personally, politically. I mean, while I was writing the book, I'm trying to do my part in Democracy Greensboro, which is this movement to try to create a progressive city council and, right, you know, and shift the discourse toward needs as opposed to profits. And, you know, that thing, I mean, my role in it dissolved.
Talk a little bit about what that is for those that don't know.
You mean Democracy Greensboro?
Democracy mm-hmm. Greensboro came into existence because the Bernie Sanders run for the presidency, right, triggered in the minds of many, many leftists fascinating possibilities for a move forward. And
Justin's on his fourth beer.
That's
this
a
is,
lie.
This is
I
impressive.
Think you didn't like that middle one, did you?
No, it was different.
We're going to move on. We're going to move on.
Yeah, we're going to move on. All right. Yeah.
The last official question and the question that we ask everyone is...
Yeah, not a difficult question.
What
all.
Is the current state of academia?
Oh, your face just fell. Your face just fell. Y'all can't see this, but his face fell.
The current state of academia is that it is being pulverized, eviscerated, punished, and subject to all of the imperatives that every other capitalist entity is subjected to in this society. That's why Nancy McLean is coming to talk about...
Next Monday.
Next Monday. She's coming to talk about the Virginia School and the Koch brothers and how they're going to privatize everything. And so, yeah, UNCG is being privatized. A&T is being privatized. The whole thing is being privatized. And when you privatize public education, that in its essence is fascism, ownership or control of public education by private entities, in this case, the business system.
So I gotta ask how.
I gotta ask something too. So here you comes go first,
my
and I'm
here comes
second.
My neoliberalism yeah, question,
yeah.
Marianne.
Oh Jesus!
I'm just curious, like your understanding of the distinction between kind of neoliberal ideology and fascism, because the way you just described that privatization, one of the key pillars of neoliberalism.
Neoliberalism is the last stage of liberal capitalist democracy. When Cornel West said liberalism, the collapse, the end of liberalism has led to fascism, from the standpoint of political economy, that's what he was saying. Hmm. The attempt to remove all obstacles to the free flow of capital in order to maximize profit at the level of credit and finance required that liberal capitalist democracy exist on an economy in which paper, not fictitious capital, became more important than productive capital, until it contributed to an ideological crisis that led to the election of Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump.
So neoliberalism.
He just ignored it.
Neoliberalism is the crisis of neoliberalism is the bridge to fascism. But fascist processes have always inhered in American monopoly capitalism. But in the context of crises, particularly this crisis, the crisis of an empire in decline and decay, mm-hmm. that the attempt to maximize profit at all levels is an act of desperation. Mm. It's an act of desperation. Because the logic of capitalist accumulation requires exponential growth of the economy. it without right. exponential growth,
right.
then the economy stagnates, and stagnation becomes the basis of crisis. And the crises get deeper and deeper and deeper mm-hmm. to the point where the crisis of the system becomes a crisis of class rule within the construct of what we call constitutional democracy.
And then we're in The Handmaid's Tale. Sorry. But no, I this is kind of my question back to you, similar to how you asked me earlier, are we capable now of valuing anything cooperatively, publicly, and collectively? Like, if we're willing to look at somebody and say, no, you should starve because you don't work, or you made bad choices, why should I have to pay for your health care? Like, if we're there, is there any way to get to a place where we can value each other's lives and, like, be there for each other? Like, I'm willing to make a lot of sacrifices in my life to be there for other people. But I feel alone
We're all there. We're actually all doing it every day. Yeah. We're doing it right now.
We're doing it
right now. This is who we are. This is who we are, and this is what we want. Yeah. I think what it means, though, is recognizing that so much of what we think is normal and normative is something that's been imposed on our thinking.
Right.
And those of us who are the most educated and actually carved out academic careers that to a certain extent represent the attempt to walk a tightrope on the academic path. The academic path is a tightrope now for people living in America, particularly in the social sciences, particularly in the social sciences and the humanities, where they understand that this is awful. This could be a whole lot better. What am I doing to make it better? Mm-hmm. And what am I not doing to make it better? And how much then am I a part of the awfulness? And is this what I have to do? And I think these are questions. These are the burning questions of the moment.
I wish
the three of you the best of luck because I'm glad I don't have to do this.
I was glad you're gonna die soon because you're old.
I hope that I have many years of work in me as a writer and as a musician. I think more as a writer than as a musician because there are other books that. You know, like the one I mentioned earlier, I want to eventually, I could see myself working on this thing years from now, looking at medieval history and stuff like that.
We're going to wrap things up now because we would really like to thank Dr. Michael Roberto for joining us.
Thank you.
And really encourage people to go out and check out his lecture. Because I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. I've learned a lot this time here, and I really thank you for joining us. And so on behalf of my illustrious co-hosts, Dr. Squirrelbeard and the Chameleon.
The Chameleon.
This is MLG signing off. We don't have a guest for next episode yet, so we're going to work on that and get back to you. But in the meantime, I guess, have whatever beverage sparks your fancy and enjoy some liquid philosophy. So.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Take care.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining us for Liquid Philosophy. We hope you've enjoyed your time thinking and drinking with some local college professors about what we do and why it's important. We do take the topic of drinking very seriously, and we want to make sure that no one is out there drinking and driving. Stay safe, y'all. And if you feel like you're having a problem with alcohol or other drugs, please contact your campus health department or talk to your doctor. I should probably also mention that the views of Liquid Philosophy hosts and our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro or the UNC system. That should do it for the disclaimers.
Be sure to check us out on liquidphilosophy.com for archives of all of our past episodes and to keep up to date on all of our guests.